SJBA welcome all of you to tonight's Dharma talk by Venerable Ajahn Acharlo. Let us start by paying homage to the Triple Gem. Buddham pujemi, Dhammam pujemi, Sangham pujemi.
So first of all, good evening everybody. Nice to be here. I was teaching a retreat last week at the Chempaka Buddhist Lodge. A number of the people who did that retreat are here tonight also. Familiar faces, but quite a number of people I don't think I've yet met. It's funny how life never quite goes how we think it will. About 19 years ago, as a backpacker who had been studying various types of Buddhist meditation in Thailand, I came to Malaysia, and I realized that there was a possibility to do a long retreat at the MBMC at the Penang, this Burmese style, and so I did a 1 month retreat there, and I don't know, maybe that is in part what sowed some of the conditions to be coming back. But I remember then, as a 21-year-old, I don't think I ever imagined I would come back to Malaysia and be teaching Buddhism. I remember I had a very restless mind. And actually those retreats are really hard work, huh? You would get up very early and sit and walk and sit and walk and sit and walk all day. And then the next day you get up and you do the same thing. An hour walking, an hour sitting, an hour walking, an hour sitting, an hour walking, an hour sitting. I remember there was no Dhamma talks either. Yeah, actually it was quite hard work. But I'm glad I did it. Whatever retreats I've done, I'm glad I did them. And I think that most of the people who attended the retreat last week are also glad that they did. And we have to put in a certain amount of effort and discipline and practice a lot of patience. But I remember about 2 weeks into that retreat going to the then abbot and saying, I don't think I can take it anymore. And he said, what's wrong? Because at the MBNC you're sitting and walking in a building, and I'd been living on a tropical island in Thailand and enjoying the sunsets and the breeze in the coconut palms and those kind of things, and I was saying, and I'd been studying some reflective meditations, and in that method one practices noting. Probably many of you have done these types of retreats. So I was noting, and inside all day. I said to the man, I was thinking of being a monk at this time, and he said, you need patience, you need endurance, you need to finish this, because if you don't finish this, it's very unlikely you'll make it as a monk, he said. I said, oh. He says, if you decide to do something, you should see it through. And I said, okay, well, how about, I asked him, can I go and do one of my 1 hour walking sessions on the grass outside once a day, please? And he was very kind, he allowed that. And I also asked him, can I do some reflective meditation, use another part of the mind? I think they call them the protective meditations or the guardian meditations, where one practices recollection of the qualities of the Lord Buddha, awareness of death and impermanence, and loving kindness meditation. He said, yes, yes, you can do those. So with that permission, I did survive and finish that 1 month retreat. And then, so that's my last memory of Malaysia, actually. But I did have quite a nice adventure. I went all the way down to Johor, and then I started hitchhiking. This is as a 21-year-old. And I went to Tioman Island, and I caught the train, they call the jungle train. I had another friend in those days, a Swiss lady, and she had a Malaysian boyfriend, and they had bungalows at the base of some huge mountain. I don't know exactly where it was, but she gave me directions. And so I remember I had to get off at a train station in the middle of nowhere, catch a taxi across some river, and start walking up a muddy trail. And sure enough, she was there. But I remember that was kind of exciting to be doing that at 21. But I have a very fond memory, actually, of being on the train going up to Kota Baru. And there was a Malaysian lady, a Malaysian Muslim, and she was sitting in a chair facing me, and she had this big bag of rambutan, and she looked at me, and she thrust this bag of rambutans into my lap, and she instructed me, "You eat," she said, in Bahasa I didn't understand. But anyway, I had one, and then I had another, and then I thought, okay, I should give them back now. And she was very determined that I should eat all of them. And I was very touched, because this is a sense of dana, isn't it? And being friendly and kind and generous to strangers, and probably in those days having moments of missing my mum as well. So this woman showed this mother-like care. I was very touched. It's a nice memory. And then it was after that trip that I went back to Penang and did this long retreat. And I'm very grateful for that opportunity. I remember in those days I didn't have very much money, and I was discussing with the people who ran that center how long I could do a retreat, and they were like, well, try a month first, and if you like it, you can do it longer. And just beginning to notice and enjoy this really beautiful Buddhist tradition of dana that supports practice. It's actually very rare in the world. If you're in places like America or Europe, most meditation retreats cost a lot of money. So this is really, again, I was very touched. So I was able to stay there. I made a small donation, and again, grateful to the generosity of the Malaysians at that time. Anyway, with regards to the theme of the talk, Buddhist practices enabling inner confidence. So I want to mention that when I say inner confidence, I'm not talking about self-confidence. I'm not talking about American style, being very confident about one's opinions and being very confident about speaking out, and that's not the kind of confidence when I say inner confidence. When I use the phrase inner confidence, I'm referring more to qualities such as dignity and self-respect. And then, of course, faith. But what comes with faith is a sense of having a direction, having a purpose, and something which is enriching in all of our lives, I'm sure we all happily acknowledge, is that, you know, just knowing that there is a reason to be alive, that there's a, especially for Buddhists, we recognize that we have a very special potential. So, and that's all human beings. So when one embraces our refuge and undertakes Buddhist practice in a disciplined way, then that sense of one's potential becomes something one is aware of, something that one is striving to develop. And it's actually very optimistic. So I grew up in Australia, of course, and so in my childhood, I didn't have that. I didn't have that sense of there's a deep meaning to life. I didn't have the sense that there is a profound and beautiful goal that one could realize. And I didn't have that sense that one's own mind is a treasure. So in Australia, it's very materially abundant, and neither of my parents were church-going people. And so we grew up with a lot of pleasure, very good food, and a lot of time on the beach, and various types of entertainment. But I never had that sense of recognizing my potential and recognizing the true value of a human birth. So by the time I was adolescent, actually, I had a deep feeling that something was lacking, something was missing. And this was actually quite a sad experience, this sense of not knowing, having a feeling that there was a meaning to life, but not knowing what it was actually quite sad. And then the other thing which was sad or alienating about that experience was, I remember looking at my parents, and they're very good people, but I remember on an intuitive level having a sense that they couldn't really teach me whatever it was I was looking for. And unlike you people who are born into a place where there is some respect for religion and you have access to some teachings, there wasn't even a vocabulary or a language. So it was very difficult to articulate even what I was feeling, but there was this sense that Mum and Dad don't know, whatever it is. And similarly at school, all of those years of school, 12 years of education, and I remember the stuff my teachers were teaching me, and I remember looking at them, and I remember feeling very frustrated, and a similar feeling of these people can't really teach me. And they used to get upset with me. I was a B+ student, and my teachers used to get upset because they felt confident that I could be an A student. And I could never really embrace all of the study that would have been required to go from a B+ to an A, because I just didn't really see the value of it. And when my report card came home, and my father, he used to get upset and he used to scold me. He said, each of your teachers are saying, my name is Brett, each of your teachers are saying Brett could do better. So my father was saying, so why don't you do better? And even then I couldn't explain to him. It's just like, I can't, there's something about this stuff that they're teaching me that I cannot surrender to wholeheartedly. And I didn't know what I could surrender to wholeheartedly, but it wasn't algebra or calculus or biology or geography. So this was frustrating, and it was an alienating experience. Then when I was accepted to study university, I actually decided not to go. I had a deep intuition. I was a very intuitive kid, sensitive and intuitive, emotional. And I had a very strong feeling of, this is a trap, don't do it. And so I was accepted to do, I think it was called a Bachelor of Behavioral Studies, some kind of psychology. And it said on the form that you couldn't defer that course, you had to take that course. And I lied to my parents. They said, I'm deferring. I'm going to take a year off, I'm going to save up some money, and I'll do it next year. And of course, I just never sent the form in. And so that gave me a year with Mum and Dad thinking, well, he'll save money and he'll go next year. But I remember thinking, well, what am I going to do? And just not knowing. And so actually I started to pray, funny enough. And having never gone to church, and having not learnt, my parents didn't allow us to go to religious class, which in those days was Christian. The only religion studied was Christian, and my parents didn't allow us to go because they didn't have faith. And I started to pray, but I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe in a creator God, but I had some kind of belief in what Buddhists would call devatas, radiant beings. And when I was 15, I went to the Hare Krishna restaurant in Brisbane, and they give good free vegetarian food. And they talked about a little bit about the Hindu philosophy there, and they mentioned the word reincarnation and karma. When I heard those words as a 15-year-old, I had this deep, strong feeling of, I believe that is the truth. Karma functions in the universe and rebirth is happening. So I really believe that. But I didn't believe that Krishna for whatever reason, Krishna didn't seem to be a refuge to me at that point. But at least it opened up the possibility of karma and rebirth, and I had a deep feeling about devas. So once I left school and I was wondering what to do with my life, I started to ask for guidance. It's a sense of there must be something out there. There must be something out there that's worth cultivating, worth giving one's life to. And I was very fortunate because Goenkaji, Mr. Goenka, had opened a couple of centers in Australia by that time. So there was a Vipassana meditation center. But actually this is 2 years later, so I had 2 years of still looking and not really finding, and during that time I studied massage, vegetarian cookery, acting, singing. And I remember I was studying acting in Sydney, and I went to two agents. And you go in and you look at this book of all these beautiful men and beautiful women, and you look at the walls and they're just covered with beautiful men and beautiful women, and I had this horrible sense of not wanting to be a consumer product. And the other thing I noticed about that is if one does aspire to be an actor, it's like if you wake up in the morning and you have a pimple, it's a really bad thing. And I remember thinking, you know, I'm not sure if I want to spend my life worrying about whether or not I have a pimple and not allowing any body fat at all and all of that stuff. So acting wasn't it. And so I just started working in a in a vegan restaurant. So, okay, well, this is right livelihood. This is harmless. And it was good food as well. And I was still kind of wondering what to do with my life. But then a couple of those people at that vegan restaurant had done this Goenka retreat. And they'd said it was a good thing. So I had an interest in meditation, and so I just went. At the age of 20, I went to this Vipassana retreat. It was one of those 10-day retreats. This was even more difficult than the one at MBMC because it was 12 hours a day of just sitting. And I'd never sat on the floor like this before. And anyway, a lot of pain, really a lot of pain. And Mr. Goenka was saying through tapes and through videos, he just kept saying, start again, start again. This mindfulness of feelings in the body. There was so much pain. But I remember that some of the teachings from the recorded talk in the evening really made sense. There was... It's been a long time since I've listened to them, but something he was talking about dukkha. He was talking about the first noble truth of dukkha. And you know, people who are old Buddhists, I think when someone explains something that one's been aware of, kind of aware of this sense of things being unsatisfactory since childhood, but then you see all the advertising that if you fall in love, you'll be happy, really happy. Or if you get the right consumer products, you'll be really happy. If you get the career that you want, you'll be really happy. And I just remember knowing that for myself, a career, a relationship, consumer products, that's not going to make me happy. And I remember being really worried about myself. I was thinking, what's wrong with me? All of this stuff makes other people happy. It's not going to make me happy. Even if it's the most beautiful person, even if it's a lot of money, I know it's not going to make me happy. So when Mr. Goenka said, according to Lord Buddha, unsatisfactoriness is the nature of the world, and that the nature of conditions is unsatisfactory, I felt such a tremendous relief. Like, oh, I'm a Buddhist. It is unsatisfactory. That was such a relief to hear as a 20-year-old. But even better than that was the beginning of the intuition and the insight that one has about mindfulness and wisdom and samadhi, or various path factors, spiritual faculties, spiritual powers. And it was this beginning of this insight that which knows suffering isn't suffering. So now we're talking about a mental quality. Now we're talking about the mind being a refuge and having a refuge if it's trained. And I'll get back to that soon. Anyway, a very good thing happened on day 7. Can you imagine? 7 days of all this pain. But on day 7, and it was really just for a few moments, all of this pain in the body, shoulder pain, back pain, and knee pain, and numb bottom, and it all disappeared. All of the pain disappeared. And there was an experience of coolness, and an experience of fullness, and an experience of putting things down. And it was really just a few seconds. But it was the first time in this lifetime that I felt, I can say, full. Or that I felt any deep sense of well-being. And it was just a couple of seconds, and then all this pain came crashing back. But it was very important, because it was profoundly orienting, because just those couple of seconds, there was something in me that recognized, this is it. That's what I'm looking for. That's what I trust. That's worth pursuing. And then, fortunately, Mr. Goenka said, meditation, like anything, if you want good results from it, you have to have a discipline. And you have to maintain your discipline. And so Mr. Goenka said, an hour in the morning and an hour at night, every day. Which is obviously a lot to take on, but I tried. I thought, yeah, that's... I really want to experience more of this. I really want to know what that's about and cultivate it, experience it. So I think for the first 2 months I was able to do an hour in the morning and an hour at night. And then it became an hour once a day. And then after another couple of months it became 45 minutes once a day. And I think it got down to 20 minutes once a day, which is what happens, isn't it? If we're not really, really determined. And that was over a year and a half. And but I think partly the good karma that that produces. Now, I believe that meditating produces good karma. The Buddha says so. You get your good karma from dana, and your good karma from keeping ethical precepts, maintaining sila, being virtuous, and you get your good karma from mental cultivation. The good karma that comes from mental cultivation is more powerful, it's more meritorious. So once again I was still praying to these devas that I couldn't see as a, for some kind of sense of direction. And at that point I wasn't sure about sila either. As an Australian, a 20-year-old Australian, I wasn't so sure about those five precepts. But my good fortune was I had a strong intuition about Thailand. I started to have a strong feeling, and I think meditating is part of what made the mind sensitive enough to start to be aware of these feelings. So I had a strong feeling about going to Thailand. And a week before I left, I decided I was going to go. And a week before I left, a woman walked into the vegetarian cafe where I was working, looking for a job. And she asked for a job. And I said, well, I'm leaving, so there may be one. And she said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to Thailand. And she said, I just came from Thailand yesterday, she said. She was Canadian. And she said, why are you going? And I said, well, it's coming up to winter and I don't like the cold and I really like the beach. That was the first thing I said, I'm embarrassed to say. The second thing I said was, and I'm interested in Buddhist meditation. And my very good fortune was this woman said, I know of a meditation center on a tropical island with a view of the ocean, with English-speaking teachers who teach 10-day retreats. And she wrote that address down. And that was a... So I believe the reason this was possible is the meditating every day, and also perhaps some support from past lives. Some practice in past lives. So I ended up spending quite a bit of time on that island with the teachers. And this is interesting as well because it's Thailand, but there was a married couple, Stephen Rosemary Weissman. He was American and she was Australian. And they had this system where you could help them run a retreat and help with cleaning and these things, and then you could sit a retreat, and then you could stay a long time without paying. So off I went, and I stayed there for a long time, and they were teaching, you know, death, awareness of death, and they were teaching awareness of karma. Something that they taught, which was very important, I think, for all of us, is recognizing one's good fortune. That was one of the reflective meditations that they taught. Because until I landed on that island in the Gulf of Thailand, I didn't even know that I was fortunate. A sense of, like, if you grow up not having a sense of refuge and not having much faith and becoming a little depressed, then you don't feel like you're fortunate. And then these people, you know, pointed out to me, you know, health, relative intelligence, freedom to travel, freedom from debt, parents were in good health, and I started to recognize there were a bunch of things present that I hadn't recognized. And then, of course, you've met the Buddha's teachings at the age of 20, and at that time 21, and they really impressed in my mind that I had a special opportunity this lifetime. And I'm very grateful to Steve and Rosemary. And I'm also grateful just the whole way it worked out, because I'll be honest with you, as a 21-year-old, if I was in Australia in a meditation center and I had to keep precepts and I had to wash sheets and paint things, and if it wasn't for the tropical location, I don't know if I could have stayed. There was something about those sunsets and the coconut palms and the balmy breeze and the curry, the Thai curry, which made it all a bit more interesting. And so I stayed there for many months, and I said I wasn't so sure about these precepts. So I have something to confess. I would come down to Malaysia after 3 months to do my visa, and I broke one or two of those precepts, and I'm not telling you which ones. But what's interesting was, back at the meditation center, I had this sense of, it's okay to break the precepts, sometimes it is. That's the middle way. That was Ajahn Acharya's middle way, not the Buddha's middle way. And so break one or two, go back. And I just had to admit, when I got back to the meditation center, that I was happier before I broke them. And then kilesa and delusion being what it is, after a couple of months and it was time to do the visa again, I also thought, no, it's okay. It's okay to break them and do it again, and then come back with the same experience of, you know what, before I broke the precepts, the mind had more clarity, more well-being, more brightness, and I broke the precepts, I came back, I feel more anxious, more depressed. I said, this is interesting. So I had to somewhat begrudgingly start to admit that keeping the precepts was really helpful. Then I was still wondering what I was going to do with my life, and I met somebody who had been to Wat Nanachat recently, and then I found out that there was a monastery in Thailand for English-speaking people, and I went and I had a look at what it was about. And I remember thinking at the time, I can't be a monk, there's too many rules. 227. And they're pretty strict, it covers just about everything. And but then they had this gradual training where one keeps 8 precepts for 6 months, 10 precepts for 1 year, and you can make a decision about whether you're going to continue. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to try. And there's something else here. This is what I think makes me think that there may have been some Buddhist practice in the past, is that I had this awareness that to be in a foreign country, but in a monastery where the teaching was taught in one's own language, and where the visa would be taken care of, and where the food was okay, and where the teacher was kind, and there I was at the age of 21, And I had this very strong feeling, although I don't feel like I can do it, I had this very strong feeling of this is the result of past karma, good karma. And I had this feeling of if you walk away from this situation, do you think, I was asking myself this question that was arising, if I walked away from this situation where everything is there, the only thing missing is my commitment. I had that sense, if I walk away from this situation, I had this sense, do you ever think you'll get such an opportunity again? And I also knew something else. I knew something about my character being somewhat artistic in temperament. I had a feeling that this lifetime, if I wasn't going to be very good, I'd probably be very bad. It was just some kind of a feeling of knowing my character, that if I didn't commit to this, being emotional and sensitive, and that I might. So I had this very clear sense of this, as difficult as it is going to take you somewhere good. And the other way isn't. And another thing was happening. All these other people were coming to the monastery who really wanted to be monks and had various obstructions. Some of them had sick parents. Some of them were putting brothers or sisters through university and meeting all these Thais with great faith who wanted to be monks but couldn't, and who were coming to practice for a week or coming to practice for 10 days or coming to practice for a month. And then I realized I have no serious commitments, no serious other obligations. And I had a very strong feeling that I had to try. And then, long story short, I found that keeping the precepts and meditating daily was extremely helpful for developing a sense of well-being and exactly what I've been talking about, inner confidence. I know Malaysians have a lot of faith, and I think you know, it's really important that we understand what we have faith in. And I know that there's been a lot more material available, a lot more resources available, a lot more teachers visiting, and I know people are really, really beginning to study and question and examine this. So faith is a very powerful quality in having joy and in having energy and in feeling that there's a purpose to life. But then we have to know what we have faith in. So the Buddha, okay, we have faith that the Buddha got enlightened. We have faith that the Buddha did uproot greed, hatred and ignorance from his mind. Okay, so that's why we have faith in the Buddha. But then we also have faith, this very fact of the enlightenment of the Buddha, it mirrors something back to us, and this is very, very important. It mirrors back to us that if the Buddha can do it, having been born as a human being, that means I also have that potential. And Lord Buddha, of course, says as much. So then you can have some faith in your potential. And this is very empowering. You don't need to be praying to devas to get a potential that you don't have. The potential is right there. It's a matter of cultivating that potential, developing that potential, or in a manner, unearthing it, taking away things which obstruct it. And then we have the Dhamma, when the Buddha basically explains how to do this, how to contain and weaken these very powerful root defilements of greed and hatred, and how to contemplate in ways which chip away at that delusion, and how to meditate in ways which cultivate insight, and it's all very clear what one needs to do. What we don't know is how long it will take for us as individuals. That's what we don't know. And this will depend largely upon how much we practiced in the past. So when it comes to our Dhamma practice, there does need to be a certain amount of humility and patience. That basically we need to do it, and we do it with confidence, but we shouldn't actually have a time frame. Basically, things will ripen when they're ripe. So we have these spiritual faculties, capacity to have faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration and wisdom. That's a faculty that we have. We have to cultivate those so that they become powers. The Buddha said that these five qualities, when developed, lead to the deathless and merge in the deathless. So the deathless is another word for the unconditioned. It's another word for nirvana. I really love this list. I was putting a lot of emphasis upon it in the retreat that I taught last week because it's easy to remember and it's very clear. And the Buddha said, actually, Lord Buddha, after his enlightenment, was contemplating this in one of those weeks after his enlightenment when he was thinking about this incredible thing that he'd realized. He was looking back at how he'd realized it and what it was that he'd realized. So he had all these insights about Paticchasamuppada. He had his insights about the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. But then he realized, he was reviewing all these past lives, and he was looking at these five qualities, when cultivated, lead to the deathless, merge in the deathless. That's really simple and really clear. That's why I like it. So faith. We need to have faith. What in? Buddha. What is enlightenment? Our potential. Dharma and Sangha. Dhamma being the truth, being the path, but also being truth. So when you take refuge in Dhamma, you're actually taking refuge in the ultimate truth. And when you practice Dhamma, through practicing Dhamma, you realize it. And in realizing Dhamma, you realize your ultimate nature. That's realized right here. Not in Tushita Pure Land. And no one else realizes it for you. And so this is something that when we keep our precepts and we meditate, we start to glimpse the mind without suffering, the mind without greed, the mind without hatred, the mind without delusion. You start to have moments of clarity. Very important to commit to meditation discipline so that we have those moments, these little insights. And of course, with training, little insights become deeper insights. And deeper insights become big insights, and those insights eventually become unshakable insights. But anyone who does an intensive meditation retreat sincerely will have moments where they glimpse a mind without, as I did all those years ago in Australia, it was just a few seconds, but it really proved to me that was an experience within my mind. That was an experience of coolness, fullness, a sense of having a refuge, having a purpose. It's a very beautiful experience. So that's all of our potential. Then it's a matter in having faith in it and then being determined. So we have to plug away at it. It won't happen by itself. So the Eightfold Path is a karmic path. It's using karma. By cultivating the Eightfold Path, it will lead to what the Buddha calls the other shore. But we have to do it. It's not going to happen by itself. So in terms of what I was talking about, of course, also Sangha is refuge. I didn't mention that. So this is another thing which mirrors back our potential, that so many other people have realized this since the time of the Buddha. It's not just the Buddha, one stray example 2,500 years ago that could do this. It's quite possibly millions of people since the time of the Buddha. If you understand that for 1,000 years after the Buddha's enlightenment in India, Buddhism in northern India, it was huge. Also, the Buddha was skilled at teaching devas, so the amount of beings that realized Dhamma and were liberated, I think, is really a lot, much more than we realize. And this also should mirror back our potential. You know, this is the potential of having consciousness. Consciousness can be purified, the mind can be liberated. But then it comes back to Buddha's training, enabling inner confidence. So that's something that we have to do. We have to train ourselves. And faith gives a certain type of joy. It gives a meaning. Having a refuge gives a beautiful meaning. Knowing our potential, also very affirming, mirroring. But to realize anything, we have to put some work into it, don't we? So my suggestions to anyone who wants to experience a deep sense of inner well-being and of having a refuge, an inner refuge. So when you truly take refuge and you cultivate the path, that refuge, you start to experience it more and more here. The Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha is my refuge, and that's something there. And so I think we really need to do some formal practice in the morning before we go to work. I think it's up to you. It's always up to you. We always have a choice. But if you want to experience the inner refuge, and if you want to have that sense of confidence, and if you really want to feel like your life is worthwhile, that you're getting somewhere with your spiritual potential, that you're not neglecting your spiritual potential, you're utilizing it, engaging it, cultivating it, ripening it, then we need to do some practice. And it's good to do retreats because that's like charging up the battery and establishing the habit. And then once you've done that retreat, you have to be really determined. Okay, I'm going to do it every day. And it has to be something that you would never miss. And just as we all bathe every day, and just as we all brush our teeth, we have to make our meditation, cleaning our minds, you have to give it the same, at least the same weight. And really important to recognize that we're living in an incredibly materialistic age, and that you are being conditioned to take materialism very seriously, and that you don't need to take it as seriously as the advertisers say you need to. So we just look at how much you have to work in order to be able to upgrade your iPhone and upgrade your car and renovate your kitchen and all of the other stuff that somehow becomes a priority to keep the GDP growing. It's it's okay to question that. In fact, I think it's really important to question it. When you're looking at how much work you do and how much time you spend, then a matter of prioritizing. A matter of prioritizing that it's not an easy thing to be born as a Buddhist. It's not an easy thing to be born in a place where you have spiritual freedom. And it's not an easy thing to have met quality of the teachings that Malaysian Buddhists are now meeting. All of these things are rare and special. But if we see them frequently and we're somewhat familiar with them, we can take them for granted. And I think it's really important that we recognize our blessings, recognize the blessings in our life. And actually, having been in Malaysia just 10 days or so, I've got a really good feeling about many things in this country. One is that the level of virtue in this country is, I think, quite a bit higher than other places. And you might not recognize that. As Buddhist Malaysians, you might have a sense of maybe resenting the Shah laws or the Islamic influence or whatever. But actually, when I've seen what's happened in Thailand in just 20 years, it's really frightening what happens when a culture throws out a sense of social control on how much sensuality is allowed. Thailand has changed a lot in 20 years, and not for the good, not for the better. And in Kuala Lumpur, you just don't see the same really, really aggressively sexual content on billboards everywhere. And just get the sense that because there's less alcohol consumption, there's probably a lot less of all the other stuff that goes with that. Now, in Thailand, we all have a sense of, yeah, there's still arahants living in Thailand. I really believe so. I have the good fortune to have paid respects to some of them many times. At the same time, I'll give you an example. Some young men came and worked in the monastery where I'm an abbot, and I was just trying to get to know them, and I was asking them questions. Four young men. One was 17, one was 20, one was 21, one was 23. And I asked them if they had girlfriends. And the 17-year-old didn't. And then I asked the 23-year-old, "Do you have girlfriends?" He said, "No." And I said, "Well, what about lovers?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "How many?" He said, "Two or three." Now then I asked the 20-year-old, one of the 21-year-olds, the other one, "Do you have girlfriend?" "No." I asked him, "Do you have lovers?" He said, "Yes." I said, "How many?" He said, "Also two or three." So this is in rural Thailand, country boys, not having a committed relationship, but having two or three, which, by the way, by Thai standards might mean three or four, because they're talking to a monk, of having a lot of casual sex with no commitment. So this is now something, I know it's funny, on some angles it's funny, but on another level it's really scary. That and then this kind of karaoke bar phenomena. And, 20 years ago in Thailand, women would not wear a skirt above their knees. Very few people would. Now it's like almost everybody is up to here. I know it's kind of funny, but on another level it's like, look what happened in 20 years. And what does it mean? What does it mean in real terms? What does it mean if you're in Thailand? Okay, you can go and pay respects and make offerings to a really great monk. Okay. But your neighbor is drunk every night. Your husband, if you're a woman, has a mistress and sees prostitutes. And your children are having casual sex from the age of 15. This is really serious. And it's not, I'm not saying it's not always that bad, but what I'm saying is not uncommon, being an abbot and having people come and talk to him about what's happening. So what I'm saying about Malaysia is that you have, from what appears to me, to be a genuine human realm. Ajahnanan, he says this very often. He says it very often. He says, the standard to be a human being on the level of the heart is keeping the five precepts. And he says to the people who come to his teachings on the weekends, a couple of hundred people, and he says, if you're not keeping the five precepts, you can't realistically expect to be reborn as a human being. He tells them, and he means it. Because if the mind isn't functioning with a certain level of restraint, a certain level of conscience, a certain level of moderation, it's not functioning on a human level. And if you act out sexual passion, if you act out a sense for wanting to be intoxicated and becoming reckless whenever you want to, it is closer to the animal and demon realms in terms of where the mind is really functioning. So in Thailand, you have this situation now where there are still enlightened beings. We're talking about this last generation. Now what we have to ask ourselves is, what is the likelihood of the next generation being able to develop those same insights? So we can have this kind of fixed perception, Thailand, Buddhist country, lots of great monks. But it is in the process of degenerating very seriously. And so what I'm saying here, from what I've observed, the level of sensuality is much less. The level of the family unit functioning as a family unit still seems quite solid. And that, we might not even notice it because you live here. But this is more and more rare in more and more parts of the world. So we are living in what is called a degenerating age. And if you're in one of those little islands where things aren't degenerating too quickly or too badly, you are fortunate. And many things seem to be okay here. There's a strong economy. There's a relative social cohesion. We can always look at the faults, and human beings have a gift to do this. We have a gift for seeing what we think isn't quite good enough. But actually we have to train ourselves to recognize what is good enough. And then we have to train ourselves to recognize this is really special, and I need to utilize this, because even now, actually, your opportunities are slipping through your fingers. They are. And another thing about the modern world is we don't know. There is globalization, it's all interconnected, but we don't know how stable it is. We look at the European economy, the American economy, there's some big problems. We don't know how a huge economic, a big collapse, how that would affect the world. We don't know if big wars are likely. They may be. And if with an up-and-coming Asia, a strong Asian economy, and you have Europe and America, crumbling economies, but we have to keep in mind, these two huge economies are very, very wealthy in weapons of mass destruction, aren't they? They are. So will these huge powers allow their economies to collapse and allow the Asian economy to dominate? It's a very serious question. Maybe they will. Maybe they won't. You have increasing resource scarcity on the horizon with 6 billion human beings. Less and less oil, less and less iron ore, less fresh water. And you have very powerful countries with huge populations, very hungry for resources. Will they maintain good manners when it comes to a crunch? Or, you know, will they look to Southeast Asia, where you don't have a hugely powerful, unified... So you have what you're experiencing now, that's all I'm trying to mirror back to you, might not last that long. There's always a risk in samsara for things to change dramatically overnight in ways that we never imagined. So right now, getting a bigger house, upgrading the car, checking your Facebook. It all has a certain validity. It all seems kind of important, kind of worth giving attention to. But if you knew that your opportunity was limited, if you knew that, just suppose you knew you had 1 week, or suppose you knew you had a month, or suppose you knew you had a year, what would you give focus to? That's a question you have to ask yourself. And so, as I said, experientially, I experienced from being a teenager who felt very lost and very depressed. After a couple of decades of Buddhist practice, I don't experience very much depression, and I do experience a lot of well-being, and I do experience an inner confidence about my potential. I experience a great sense of optimism about what is possible just from being conscious. And another thing which has helped me, and I want to encourage you all, obviously you're all working at it now, obviously you're all practicing because you're all here. So I recognize that, and whatever practice you've done, I really applaud it, I really rejoice. Sadhu. But one thing that helps in terms of inner confidence and self-esteem is feeling confident that one has accumulated merits. Because at the time of death, that's the only thing that you can take with you. I'll tell you a little story. A couple of years ago, I went to Ladakh, and I was there with a friend, and the whole reason that I went was to try to help that person break his alcohol habit. That person is a long-term student who has helped me in the past, helped me to see teachers, helped me to visit my parents, helped me in various ways to get where I needed to be. And he wanted to go to Ladakh, which is a Buddhist area in the Indian Himalayas between Pakistan and Tibet. So I said, okay, I'll go if you promise that you won't have a single drink during that time and that we go for at least a month. And my intention was to, and that he meditated twice a day at least with me. And so we agreed to that. During the time that we were in Ladakh, Ladakh had its worst natural disasters in modern history. They had unseasonal rainstorms. I think you'll probably remember that Pakistan was very seriously flooded at that time. Terrible, terrible floods. So Ladakh, being on the border of Pakistan, got some of these floods. Now Ladakh is a place where it doesn't rain. I think they get 3 centimeters of rain a year. And it snows in winter. And then that snow slowly melts down beautiful crystal clear snow-fed streams into the Indus Valley. And so you have these beautiful white caps, you have no trees, it's very high. And you have trees alongside the rivers, but outside of that there's no trees. And so while we were there, it was a very serious downpour that went all night. And then I think 300 or 400 people died in mudslides, and the whole state's bridges washed away, because those mountains are basically dust and stones piled very, very high from where two continents crashed into each other a long time ago. So it's not very stable land. At that time, many people in Ladakh were very frightened. They'd never seen a thunderstorm. Now, coming from Thailand, that's just what happens, and heavy rain is no big deal. But when you live in Ladakh and your village is alongside the river at the foot of a very steep mountain and it rains very hard, it's a very serious disaster. It's the end of the world. And hundreds of people with no warning covered in 2 meters of mud in the middle of the night in their sleep. Very, very awful. So we were there when this occurred, and we had no idea that 2 kilometers away, 200 people had been covered in mud. And we were in a guest house on the edge of Leh with a lovely Buddhist family, and I was basically doing a retreat, taking the opportunity to practice a lot. Now what happened was there were very big clouds again in the sky, and everyone was panicking. And the water was coming down in what's usually quite small streams. You could hear the boulders moving at the bottom of the river, and you could see trees going past. It was a lot of water come down very quick. Everyone was beginning to panic, and they said, we all need to go and meet in town. They're saying that the people should stick together. And I just had this very strong feeling, if you're in a valley, surrounded by mountains and the mountains are slipping, there's nowhere safe. You can go to the top of the mountain, but that might be the mountain that turns into a mudslide. And where in a valley is going to be safe? And I had this strong intuition, there's nowhere safe. And if it's time to die, it's time to die. And rather than be with a bunch of people who are panicking, I said to my friend, well, you can go with these people if you want to, but I'm going to my room and I'm going to meditate. And so I had a little shrine and I lit incense and I lit candles and I sat in half lotus and I started to think about my life. And there was a little bit of fear, but I started to think of what I'd done in this life that was worthwhile. And then it occurred to me that gone forth as a bhikkhu, kept very good precepts for 15 years. I've paid respects to enlightened beings many times. I've been on pilgrimage to India. I've meditated every morning, every afternoon, every night for a long time. And I had this sense of, well, I would have liked to have developed deeper insight. I would have liked to have developed deeper samadhi. And I would have liked to have had the opportunity to practice longer. But overall, that's a pretty good life. I had that sense. And I had a sense of, I can go now. I can go now. If 2 meters of mud is going to come down and squash me and suffocate me, okay. And so this was really revealing to me. This was really... And the other thing, it had a very good effect on the other people because everyone else said, okay, well, if the monk isn't going, we're not going either. And they went back to their rooms and also meditated. And there's a sense of, if the time to die is now, you have to make yourself calm, recollect the good things that you did, feel joy and feel content, and be ready to go. So that's the question, or what I would suggest to you is, as your death approaches, and you have to admit that it's definitely coming anyway, whether it's next week or next month or next year, it's coming. This is fundamental to Buddhist practice. We all have to acknowledge this is a very powerful meditation recommended by Lord Buddha to be practiced on a daily level. In the face of awareness of death, we learn how to focus. It's like, okay, imagine that you're really going to die today or tomorrow. How would that affect what you do with your day? How would that affect what you do with this week? And then you want to ask yourself, okay, when I die, how can I have that feeling of contentment, that feeling of that was a life well spent? So I wanted to share that with you, and I wanted to just suggest that to you. And I'm not saying I haven't made mistakes. I'm not saying when faced with the possibility of dying there was that sense of, oh, I wish I hadn't done that, and I wish I hadn't done this. But there was always also that sense of, okay, well, it's done now. And if you really are going to die, you better focus on what was good. And when I thought about what was good, you know, there really was something there. So that's what I want to suggest in terms of having inner confidence and genuine self-esteem. It's what kind of punya have you accumulated in your human birth, this human life, with regards to your very special human potential? How much have you cultivated it? And maybe there are obstructions, maybe there are very serious duties, then okay, at least when you're dying you can feel like you've done your duties, there's nobility in that as well. But the suggestion is, don't lose your opportunity. Accumulate as much merit as you can, understanding that the thing that produces most merit is practice itself, and then cultivate that potential or realize that potential to as greater degree as you can. So that's the friendly advice I'd like to offer tonight.